I want you to put yourself in a very specific physical space right now.
Okay, let's set the scene.
Yeah, so just picture the blinding dry heat of an ancient courtyard. The air is thick with dust. The sun is, you know, completely unforgiving.
Right.
And you are standing in the shadows just watching this man named Ammar al-Sabbati. Mm. And you can see the tension in his shoulders.
Like you can physically feel it.
Exactly. He is approaching Ja'far al-Sadiq, the sixth imam of Shia Islam. And Ammar is not there to ask some casual theological question about prayer or fasting.
No, not at all.
No, he is approaching this towering figure of spiritual authority the way like a desperate man might approach a king. He is begging for the absolute highest clearance imaginable.
Yeah, high is the high.
He is asking for a universe altering secret. So he falls to his knees, or well, at least lowers his head in total submission. Okay. He says, "May I be made your ransom. Tell me the greatest name of God."
It is really one of the most arresting cold opens to any historical report in this entire tradition.
It's wild.
It is. We really need to dwell on what Ammar is actually demanding here. The tradition refers to it as the greatest name, and the stories surrounding this concept are, frankly, they're terrifying in their scope.
Terrifying is the right word.
Right, because we are talking about a name by which the physical laws of the universe are simply suspended.
Wow.
Yeah, a name by which the dead are pulled back from their graves. Mm-hmm. A name by which a solid physical throne can be teleported across a massive sprawling kingdom in like less time than it takes your eyelid to flutter.
It's pure power.
Exactly. And Ammar wants it. He wants to hold it. He is asking for it like it's a secret password, you know, some phonetic spell that will allow him to just hack the machinery of reality.
Which is, I mean, that's exactly how we usually think of secrets, right? As information.
Right, like a combination to a safe.
Yeah, you learn the digits, you turn the dial, the door clicks open. But the imam's answer to Ammar completely defies that expectation.
It really does.
Because he doesn't say no. He doesn't say, "I don't have it." He doesn't even say, "You are not worthy of it," which is, you know, the classic mystical gatekeeping trope.
No, the imam looks at him, and I am going to read the exact reply slowly, because I want you to feel the physical weight of this warning. The imam says, "You will not be able to bear it."
You will not be able to bear it.
Not, "You won't understand
it." Right. You won't be able to carry the physical and spiritual crushing weight of it.
Exactly.
But, you know, Ammar is human. And human curiosity, especially when it's near some perceived source of ultimate power, is entirely stubborn. So Ammar insists.
He pushes back.
Yeah, he begs. And finally the imam says, "Then stay in your place." The imam stands up, turns his back on Ammar, and just walks out of the courtyard and into the house.
Leaving him out there?
Leaving him in the dust. A heavy silence falls. A moment later, a voice calls out from the doorway, telling Ammar to come inside. So Ammar steps over the threshold into the dim light of the house.
This is where it gets crazy.
It does. The imam looks at him, and there is almost a gentleness to this final warning, and he asks, "What is it?" And Ammar, just completely blind to what is about to happen, says it again. "Tell me the name."
And here is where the scene fractures. The historical report from the collection known as Basair al-Darajat details what happens next. And it breaks the normal rules of human experience.
It breaks reality.
Yeah. The imam doesn't speak a syllable. He doesn't write anything on a piece of parchment. He simply lowers himself and places his bare hand flat on the ground.
He touches the earth. That's all. And instantly, Ammar watches the walls of the house begin to turn around him.
Just spinning.
The floor, the ceiling, the entire architectural structure starts to violently spin. Mm-hmm. It isn't a metaphor. It is a physical, terrifying vertigo.
It's completely visceral.
Something enormous, like something impossibly heavy and overwhelmingly real, takes hold of his physical body and his mind. And Ammar says later, and I want to quote his exact phrasing, "I was about to perish."
He's on the edge of just blinking out.
He is standing on the absolute brink of being unmade. His ego, his body, his identity are starting to literally vibrate apart at the seams. And through the middle of this terrifying vortex, through the noise of reality breaking open, the imam just laughs.
He laughs.
Yeah. And Ammar gasps out the only thing a sane human being could say in that moment of existential terror. He says, "That is enough for me. I do not want it."
I want you, the listener, to really sit with that feeling for a moment. Just hold on to that intense, terrifying vertigo, because the entire architecture of our deep dive today is built inside that spinning room.
Right. We have to figure out what was in that room.
We have to ask ourselves a fundamental question. What could a name possibly be. Knowing it is not like learning a new vocabulary word, but like standing completely exposed, far too close to a raging, consuming fire.
Yeah. What kind of name threatens to literally dissolve your existence just by coming near its perimeter?
We need to hold on to that mystery.
Yeah.
The answer to that specific question is exactly where this journey is going to conclude today.
And it's a mystery that actually, you know, forces us to confront a massive, glaring contradiction that we have been carrying around with us since we started this entire series.
We have been avoiding it.
We have. So let's trace our steps back for just a moment to see the trap we are in. In our first deep dive, we established the core foundational claim of this philosophical tradition,
which is that God is not just the biggest, most powerful being on a list of other beings.
Right. God is pure, unbounded being itself. Pure, unadulterated existence with absolutely no limits, no parts, no borders, no internal divisions.
It's completely seamless.
Yeah. He is so utterly and perfectly one that a second isn't just missing from the equation. A second is logically impossible to even conceive.
Exact.
Then in our second deep dive, we explored what that infinite seamless reality means when it collides with a finite, fragile human life.
Which leaves us with an incredibly obvious structural problem that we have until now deliberately ignored.
The elephant in the room.
Right. If God is truly that perfectly seamless, if there are no divisions, no distinct compartments, no separate attributes bolted onto the divine reality, where in the world do all the names come from?
Exactly. You open the Quran and it calls him by name after name, page after page.
Dozens of them.
The merciful, the knowing, the mighty, the forgiving, the creator, the king, the light. There's a very famous, widely circulated tradition that says he has 99 names.
Yes.
So how does the one, the absolute, undivided, unfractured one of our first discussion, come to wear 100 different faces? It feels like a mathematical impossibility.
It does.
And if there are really that many distinct names, which one of them could possibly be the greatest? I mean, how do you rank pieces of an indivisible whole?
To untangle this knot, we are returning to our guide for this series, the great Iranian philosopher, mystic, and Quranic commentator from the 20th century, Ah-Elia-Meh Tabarabai.
We will refer to him simply by his honorific, Ah-Elia-Meh, which translates to the most learned.
Right. For this specific problem, we are looking at the second treatise in his masterwork, Ar-Rasathil al-Tawhidiyah, which means treatises on divine unity.
Oh.
Or to use the exact terminology, treatises on Tawhid.
I love how Al-Aimah opens this particular treatise because he essentially plants his flag in the ground before he even begins the argument.
He really does.
He tells you exactly how he is going to operate, and he takes a very subtle but very sharp swing at the academic establishment.
Oh, absolutely.
He states that he is going to run pure, rigorous philosophical reasoning and scriptural revelation side by side, proving that they confirm each other perfectly. But then he adds a caveat.
A very important caveat.
He pointedly notes that the only books worth reading on the subject of Tawhid are the ones that successfully join flawless logical proof with actual mystical taste, direct lived experience.
It is a brilliant critique. He is taking aim at the vast libraries of routine, dry, argumentative theology.
Boring stuff.
Yeah, the kind of theology that starts with whatever sounds superficially plausible to an untrained common sense mind, and then just stubbornly defends it using clever debate tricks and linguistic gymnastics.
Moving words around on a page.
Exactly. Ah-Elia-Meh is warning the reader, you know, if you want to understand the nature of the divine, yes, you absolutely need the cold math-like precision of logic. But logic alone is a map, not the territory.
You also need the direct burning encounter. You need the spinning room.
Yes. That combination tells you exactly the kind of rigorous yet deeply experiential company this text expects you to keep.
So we need to start where he starts. We have to unpack his core technical definition of what a divine name actually is, because if we get this wrong, I mean, the rest of the deep dive will make absolutely no sense.
It's the foundation of everything.
He sets a firm rule.
Yeah.
A name is not a sticky label that we imply to God from the outside. Like when I get a dog and I name him Spot, I'm just attaching a random sequence of sounds to a biological creature. The sound spot has nothing to do with the dog's essence. But a divine name, in Ah-Elia-Meh's strict philosophical sense, is the essence itself, considered together with one of its attributes.
That is the pivotal concept upon which this entire towering structure rests. We must remember that God's single, seamless reality already contains, as one entirely undivided, simple thing, the full actualized reality of every possible perfection.
All of it at once.
Yes. Knowing, living, power, generosity, beauty. They are not distinct organs. They are all there, perfectly unified as one existence.
Right.
So to name him the knowing is not to identify a specific knowing part of God. It is simply to point at that one single absolute reality from the specific angle of its knowing.
I'm trying to visualize this so it doesn't just sound like wordplay. I think of it like looking at a massive monolithic mountain.
Okay, I like that.
You can stand to the north and look at the north face. You can walk around and look at the south face. The mountain itself doesn't have seams. It doesn't have a painted dividing line where the north stops and the south begins.
No, it's continuous.
It is just one continuous, unbroken piece of rock. The name North Face adds absolutely nothing to the mountain. It doesn't change the rock. It's just a specific, limited angle of looking at one undivided reality.
That's a great way to put it.
So whenever we talk about a name today, we have to keep that rule locked in our minds. The name adds nothing to God. It is a lens, a way of looking. It is not a new part.
That is a very helpful framing. Every name is one single reality. Seen from one side.
Mm.
But, you know, accepting that rule, it immediately brings us to our first major structural hurdle.
Here we go.
If every name is just the exact same essence seen from an angle, why are there different categories of names? Why organize them at all?
Good question.
LAMS surveys the vast landscape of divine names and sorts all of them into three distinct families. And we need to walk through this sorting carefully because this isn't just trivia.
Right.
This categorizing is the map we need to navigate the vertigo we introduced at the beginning.
Okay, let's take them one by one. The first family he introduces, he calls the essential names. These are the names that are fundamentally true of God all by himself.
Right.
Like, you do not need to bring the created universe or anything outside of God into the picture at all to understand them.
Precisely. Think of foundational names like the living, the knowing, the powerful.
Okay.
You do not need to suppose a universe full of spinning galaxies, oceans, and people for the statement God is alive to be true. It is true of him considered entirely on his own, in absolute infinite isolation.
That makes sense.
You don't need an external object to exist for God to be intrinsically knowing in his essence, because he perfectly knows himself.
Mm-hmm.
These are the essential names. They require no outside reference point.
That makes perfect logical sense. But then we cross over into the second family, and this is where a really fascinating philosophical puzzle surfaces, like one that I think trips up a lot of people.
Oh, definitely.
OLAME calls this second group the names of the act. These are names like the creator, the provider, the reviver, the one who gathers, the one who originates, the one who gives life and causes death.
Right. Active verbs.
Now, if you are listening closely, you should immediately spot the glaring issue here. These names only seem to make sense if there is a creation in view. God is the creator because there is something actively being created. He is the provider because there is a physical creature opening its mouth needing to be provided for.
It is a profound, deeply unsettling philosophical worry.
Right. Because I really want to push back on this logically. If we established in episode one, I mean, in our first deep dive, that God is eternally perfect, that he never changes and never acquires new parts.
Right.
Does this mean that before the physical universe existed, God wasn't the creator? Did he somehow acquire a brand new name, a new status, or a new role the exact moment he made the first atom?
That's the trap.
Because if he acquired something new, that mathematically implies he was lacking something before. It implies he grew or improved or changed, which entirely shatters our definition of pure, perfect being.
That is the exact trap that has ensnared lesser theologians for centuries. And L.A. May navigates it with an incredible surgical care. I want to slow down and unpack his specific answer because the nuance is everything here.
Okay, lay it on me.
Alameyana says that God is such that were a creature to be supposed, he would be its creator.
Such that.
Yes, that such that inherent boundless disposition to create is real of him eternally. It is fixed in his infinite reality forever, regardless of whether a physical universe is currently spinning or not.
So the potential is always there? Wait, not potential disposition?
Exactly.
Right.
The actual physical creature is needed only for us, from our limited vantage point, to pick out and apply the name. The creature is needed to get our human conceptual apparatus going. It is absolutely not needed to bring the relationship into being within the reality of God.
I want to make sure I really fully have my hands around this because it feels slippery. Let's use an analogy to ground it.
Please do.
Think about the sun in our solar system. The sun, by its very physical nuclear nature, is illuminating. It burns. It radiates massive amounts of light.
Right.
Now, perform a thought experiment. Imagine the sun floating in a completely empty pitch black void. There are no planets. There are no asteroids. There is no dust. There is literally nothing for the light to bounce off of.
Just a scar in the dark.
Exactly. The sun is still inherently illuminating, right? Its nature hasn't changed simply because the room is empty. Now, suddenly, put a solid planet in orbit around it. In that exact instant, the relationship of lighting appears.
Yes.
The sun is now actively lighting the planet, but I have to ask, did the sun itself change?
Not even slightly. Mm. Nothing changed in the internal nuclear reality of the sun.
Exactly. The sun didn't suddenly learn how to light up a planet. It didn't acquire a new lighting skill. The planet's arrival simply provided the surface, the mirror, for the sun's internal disposition to be seen and recognized.
Right.
The sun was always shining. And God's name as creator or provider is exactly like that. The appearance of the creature in time simply provides the mirror for the eternal disposition to be made manifest.
That is a beautiful way to visualize the dynamic.
Yeah.
But, you know, Allah Aimee is never satisfied with just a physical metaphor. He takes this a step further into a sharper, much more rigorous domain using arithmetic.
Oh, boy, math.
We must dwell on this analogy deeply, because it secretly sets up the foundation for everything that follows in this deep dive. And the next. I want you to simply think about the number four.
Okay. The number four, I'm picturing it.
Just the pure concept of four. Now, mathematically, four is necessarily an even number. It is necessarily 2 times 2. It is necessarily the square of 2.
Right.
Those properties, evenness, being a perfect square, belong to the number 4 by itself. 4 is the direct formal cause of its own evenness. If I ask you why 4 is even, you don't look outside of the number 4 to find the answer. You just look at the definition of 4.
Right. It's baked into the math. It's self-contained. And yet, here is the philosophical turn. The number 4, as a concept, as a reality that holds any meaning at all, depends entirely and continuously on God for its very existence.
Okay.
It has absolutely no independent existence, no reality whatsoever outside of the sheer being that sustains all reality. And here is the unavoidable logical step Allah forces us to take.
What's the step?
Because the number 4 depends on God for its very being. It must depend on Him for everything that flows naturally from its being, including its evenness.
Wow. Okay, let me process that. This is where it gets incredibly tense. Because on one hand, you are saying that the number 4 is genuinely doing the work of being even.
Yes.
It's not a trick. 4 is really even. But on the other hand, you're saying that God is the ultimate true source of that evenness because He is the total source of the 4 itself existing in the first place.
Precisely. So in this profound philosophical tradition states that God alone is the source of everything, it does not mean He shoulders aside the in-between causes.
Right. He doesn't micromanage the math.
Exactly. It doesn't mean He awkwardly reaches down from the sky and manually bypasses the rules of mathematics to force a number to be even. It means He is the real, sustaining, ultimate source of the reality. Even while the number 4 is genuinely, authentically busy doing its own necessary work of being genuinely even.
That is a staggering concept when you apply it outside of math. The idea that a thing can really genuinely do its own work, have its own properties, and still be wholly 100% borrowed from an ultimate source.
It changes how you see the world.
It really does. We are going to circle back to that in a major existential way later on. That specific idea of borrowed reality is going to be the absolute engine of our next deep dive into the acts of God.
Definitely.
But for now, we have the essential names like knowing, which require no universe. We have the names of the act like creator, which require a universe to manifest, even though the disposition is eternal. So what is the third and final family?
Third family Allah introduces is, at first glance, perhaps the strangest and most counterintuitive of all. He calls them the negative names.
Negative names. That sounds like an insult or at least a demotion.
It does, but it refers to grammatical negation. These are names like the holy, the pure, the flawless.
Okay, I have to stop and raise a serious philosophical objection here on behalf of the listener who has been following this logic closely.
Right.
Because we just spent, you know, our first two deep dives painstakingly establishing that God is pure, unbounded being. He is total existence, complete actuality with no holes, no lacks, no empty spaces, no potentiality in His reality.
Right.
A negative attribute inherently implies an absence. Flawless literally means a lack of flaws. How can a negative attribute, which is an absence, a non-thing, possibly name a reality that is purely real and completely full? It sounds like a direct logical contradiction.
It is a brilliant objection, and it shows you are tracking the core premises.
Mm-hmm.
If God is pure, total being, assigning a non-thing or a lack to him seems completely incoherent.
What?
But Eleme reveals the incredible logical turn hidden inside human language here.
Yeah.
It is a matter of grammar and ontological reality aligning perfectly, but operating in reverse. A negative divine attribute is actually the negation of a negation.
The negation of a negation. Like in math, where two negatives multiply to make a positive.
Exactly like that. Let's look at the word flawless when applied to a physical object, like a diamond. When you look at a diamond under a loop and call it flawless grammatically, it sounds like you are describing empty space.
Right.
It sounds like you were describing an absence. You're saying there are no flaws here.
Yeah, it sounds like you are just pointing out that something bad is missing.
But in physical reality, what are you actually pointing at? What are you affirming? You are affirming a profound, uninterrupted physical perfection. The absence of a flaw in a diamond is entirely constituted by the overwhelming presence of perfect, uninterrupted crystalline carbon structure.
Oh, wow. I see it.
The negative word is just our human shortcut for pointing to a massive positive reality that leaves no room for anything else. When we say God is free of defect, we must remember what a defect actually is.
A lack of being.
Exactly. A defect is itself a negation. A defect is a lack of being, a failure to be fully real. So denying a defect is denying a denial. It lands squarely and heavily on a massive, infinite affirmation of pure being.
So even when we use these distancing words, when we call God the pure, the flawless, we aren't talking about empty space. We aren't carving out a hollow zone.
Not at all.
We're quietly, firmly saying yes to infinite presence. The negative names are secretly the most radically affirmative names of all.
Yes. So we have our map. Three sprawling families of names. The essential, the active, the negative. But as we look at this vast array of attributes, we must recall our absolute unbreakable rule from the beginning.
The one about the mountain.
Exactly. All of them. Every single one of these hundreds of names is the exact same single undivided reality, simply looked at from different sides.
Which naturally begs the biggest structural question of this whole discussion. How do we possibly put them all back together?
That's the challenge.
We have these three sprawling families, hundreds of different names scattered across the texts of the Quran, all these different conceptual angles. How do they collapse back into absolute terrifying unity?
Yeah, because they have to, right?
They absolutely have to. If Tawheed means absolute oneness, we cannot just leave them scattered on the table. We need to map out the architecture of how the many fold back into the one.
This folding process is the beating heart of Eleme's treatise, and we need to take it very slowly, step by step. To explain how the many return to the one, he distinguishes two completely different kinds of unity in God.
Okay, two unities.
He gives them two technical Arabic names, Ahadiyya and Wahidiyya. The stark difference between these two concepts is the master key to understanding the entire map of reality.
Okay, I am writing these down. Ahadiyya and Wahidiyya. Let's start at the very bottom. What is the deepest, most foundational level?
The deepest level is Ahadiyya. This is God's reality taken in absolute, terrifying purity.
Oh, okay.
This is the level where every determination, every concept, every name, every distinction is completely and utterly erased. This is exactly the unbounded reality we talked about in our first deep dive, the reality that is so completely beyond limits that it outruns even the word absolute.
Nothing can be said.
Nothing can be said there. There are no names there. No knowing, no powerful, no merciful, just pure, sheer existence.
It's just sheer, unbroken being. But I feel like this creates a paradox immediately, doesn't it? If we are talking about a state that has no features, no determinations, isn't having no features a feature?
It creates a beautiful, inescapable paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Because even having no determination whatsoever is itself a kind of determination.
Right.
The very state of being completely beyond all determination becomes logically the first feature you can point to.
Let me try a metaphor here to ground this, because otherwise my brain is going to float away.
Go for it.
Think about sitting in a massive concert hall, waiting for a symphony to begin. The musicians are seated. The conductor hasn't walked out yet. There is pure, heavy silence in the room.
I could picture it.
Now, pure silence is just the absence of sound. It's a non-thing. But the moment you become aware of it, the moment the conductor raises the baton and holds it there, stretching the quiet, that silence ceases to be just an empty absence.
Yes.
It becomes the very first feature of the performance. It becomes the first beat of the piece. The intense tension of the silence is the music itself beginning.
That is a wonderful analogy. The instant you so much as point your conceptual mind at God's pure indeterminacy, you have made the first mark on a blank page. The determination of being beyond all determination.
That silence turning into a beat.
Yes, that first mark, that silence turning into the first agonizingly tense beat, that is, yeah.
It's almost dizzying to try to hold that in your head.
It is. And Aleme, knowing how difficult this is for the human mind, actually gives us a practical exercise.
Right.
He doesn't just leave it as abstract math. He gives us a way to find a tiny, fragile mirror of this exact state within ourselves.
Okay, an exercise.
I want to invite you, the listener, to actually do this inward-looking exercise with us right now, in real time.
Yes, wherever you are, driving, walking, sitting at a desk, just pause your outward attention and follow this logic inward. Think about yourself. Right now, in this exact second, you are knowing. You're understanding the English words we're speaking.
Right.
You are also able to act. You could reach out and turn the volume dial down or pause this track. You are also seeing perhaps the road in front of you or the room you are sitting in.
Okay, keep going.
Now look closely at those attributes. Knowing, able, seeing. Not a single one of those things is a separate physical object bolted onto your soul. They aren't tools you keep in a shed and pick up when you need them. Your knowing, your ability, your seeing, they're all simply entirely you.
Exactly. Not one of your attributes is outside you. Your knowing is you. Your power to move your hand is you. That experience, the everyday experience of having many different capacities that are all somehow just one single unified self, is a tiny creaturely mirror of how all the infinite divine names live inside the one divine essence.
But now let's take Aleme's next crucial step. Strip it back. Turn your attention away from the things you can do. Stop looking at the seeing, the knowing, the moving.
Focus solely on the bare, irreducible fact of being you.
Right. Don't think I am a person who can see. Don't think I am a person who knows. Just strip it down and focus entirely on the pure, silent, foundational thought, I am.
When you hold that pure I am, notice what happens to your attributes. They don't vanish into non-existence. You don't suddenly go physically blind or lose your memory or become paralyzed.
No, but they retreat.
They fold up. They go quiet. They become completely invisible, folded deeply into the simple, singular reality of I am.
They are totally there, but they are entirely unmanifest.
That folding away, that quiet, tense state where the many are intensely real but completely unmanifest, that is your own personal psychological taste of aha-iya. It is the level of absolute simple identity.
I love that. It makes the dizzying theology suddenly feel very intimate. So from that pure folded silence of aha-iya, how do the names actually emerge? Because they do emerge. We have a universe full of them, but they don't just spill out randomly, do they? It's not a grab bag.
No, they do not spill randomly. Aleme traces what is essentially a geometric cascade. It is an unfolding of the names outward from Ahadiya, and it happens in a strictly logical, necessary sequence.
Like mathematical steps.
It is almost like watching a master mathematician unfold complex theorems from a single, simple definition.
Let's trace that sequence slowly. What is the very first thing that comes out of the silence?
First comes sheer self-identity. The irreducible concept that he is he. Absolute, pure presence to oneself. Now follow the logic. Because that infinite reality is fully and perfectly present to itself. And because being completely present to a reality just is what the definition of knowledge is, the name knowing appears. It yields logically and necessarily from self-identity. You cannot be perfectly present to yourself without being knowing.
Okay, so sheer presence inherently yields knowing. What drops down next?
Because that reality is unbounded being, because it is the total unrestricted source of every existential perfection without limit, the name powerful appears. Infinite being is infinite power to be.
So we have knowing and powerful derived directly from the source.
And when you unite total perfect knowledge with total perfect power, their union necessarily yields life. Because what does it mean to be alive in the highest philosophical sense?
To perceive and to act.
Yes. To be alive is precisely to be a thing that perceives, which is the summit of knowledge, and a thing that acts, which is the summit of power.
So this proves it's not just a random list of compliments we thought up to flatter God in our prayers. It is a rigorous, unbreakable logical chain. He is he, which necessitates knowing, which necessitates powerful, and knowing plus powerful necessitates living. It's a cascade, one theorem yielding the next.
Which brings us, finally, to the second kind of unity. We had ahadiyya, the absolute purity, the folded silence. Now we have arrived at the level where all these names have cascaded outward into distinction. Knowing, powerful, living, merciful, provider.
This is the second level.
Yes, the second broader level is called Wahidiyya.
Wahidiyya. What defines this level? How is it different from the pure silence?
Wahidiyya is defined by a simple, elegant formula. Many meanings, but a single referent.
I feel another analogy coming on. Let's bring in a physical visualization here.
Go for it.
Imagine a prism, a solid piece of triangular glass sitting on a table. Now imagine shining one single laser-focused beam of pure white light into the side of that prism. When the light hits the geometry of the glass, it opens up, right?
It refracts.
It breaks apart into a visible spectrum. Red, green, blue, yellow. Now look at the colors. The colors are real. The red is genuinely different from the blue. It has a different wavelength. It interacts with the eye differently.
Yes, they are distinct.
But if I ask you, how many light beams are currently powering that rainbow? The answer is one. It is just one light stretched out so we can see its internal richness.
That is the perfect visualization of Wahidiyya. In the reality of God, the knower and the living and the powerful all point at the very same infinite reality from different conceptual angles.
Right.
It is a unity in which every distinct aspect is completely identical with every other aspect in reality, because they are all just the white light.
Right.
So ILA May concludes this section with a massive claim. God is both Ahad and Wahid. He is singularly, terrifyingly one at the level of Ahiyah, admitting no second pure white light before the prism. And he's one at the level of Wahidiyya, where every facet of the colorful spectrum is, in truth, the exact same single thing.
So if we have this prism that spreads the one light into many colors, can we reverse the process? If we are looking at the rainbow of hundreds of names, can we fold the map back up and find our way back to the single beam?
We can, and ILA May actually runs the prism backwards for us. It is one of the most beautiful, mathematically satisfying structural claims in the entire treatise.
How does it fold up?
If every name folds back toward the specific light it came from, where does the folding end? He traces it step by step. He demonstrates that every single affirmative name of God, and there are dozens and dozens of them, like provider, creator, sustainer, merciful, they all turn out to collapse upward into just two fundamental headwater names, knowing and powerful.
Because if you think about it, everything God does, every act of mercy, every act of creation is simply an act of knowledge applied with an act of power.
Exactly. Every positive action is power guided by knowledge. And those two headwaters, knowing and powerful, taken together, yield the self-subsistent, the one who stands entirely on his own, holding all reality up. And from power and knowledge joined, as we proved a moment ago, the name the living follows once more.
So the entire massive sprawling tree of God's affirmative names, all the infinite branches of mercy and provision and creation that touch our lives, they all trace back down the trunk to two ultimate roots. Al-Hay and Al-Qayyum, the living and the self-subsistent.
And ILA May, with his characteristic brilliance, points out that this philosophical math is exactly why the most famous, most frequently recited verse in the Quran about God's nature, the verse of the throne, says exactly this.
Right.
It doesn't list 50 names. It distills it. It says, God, there is no God but He, the living, the self-subsistent. Chapter 2, verse 255. The ancient scripture and the rigorous philosophical math arrive at the exact same coordinates.
What about the negative names, the ones we talked about earlier, like flawless and pure? Where do they go when you fold them out?
All the negative names fold upward into a single towering peak as well. Al-Qudus, the all-holy, the ultimate absolute affirmation of purity that denies all limits.
So we have two peaks, the affirmative living and self-subsistent, and the negative all-holy. Does it stop there?
No. Finally, everything, every affirmative name of overflowing beauty and every negative name of pure, untouchable majesty, they all fold one last time into a single, comprehensive name that the Quran provides as the absolute summit. Dhul Jalal wal Ikram, the Lord of Majesty and Generosity.
The majesty and generosity.
Majesty covers the untouchable height of the negative names. Generosity covers the overflowing gift of the affirmative names.
Mm-hmm.
That is the one phrase that holds all 100 faces.
If we step back and look at the whole picture ILA May has drawn for us, it's basically a massive staircase. It's a complete cosmic architecture.
Yeah.
You start at the very top, the essence. Ahiyya, pure, blinding, white light. The silence. Absolutely no multiplicity, no names, no concepts.
That's the top step.
Then you step down one level to the names. Wahidiyya, the prism. Here, multiplicity exists, but it is purely conceptual multiplicity. Many names, but one single referent. And then you step down again, all the way to the bottom, into the physical universe, into creatures. And down here, the multiplicity is concrete. It's hard physics, many different things, many different beings bumping into each other.
Essence, then names, then creatures. That three-step staircase is the exhaustive architecture of absolutely everything that exists. There's nothing else to map.
It is breathtaking in its scope. And what is so deeply fascinating about A'Aleh-Meh is that right after building this massive, flawless, philosophical structure that feels like it belongs in a geometry textbook, he does something very characteristic of him.
He pivots.
He says essentially, okay, we have the math, now check the sources. He takes all his philosophical proofs and he aggressively checks them against the messy reality of scripture and historical reports.
Yes. He turns immediately to the famous traditions, the ones most people are casually familiar with. Specifically, he tackles the famous tradition of the 99 names.
Right, the one everyone knows.
There is a very widely known hadith reported in major collections like Al-Kafi and Al-Tawhid, which states very plainly, God has 99 names. Whoever comprehends them all enters paradise.
Now, if you are a casual reader or a lesser scholar, you might expect A'Aleh-Meh to just dutifully list out the 99 names, offer a brief pious commentary on each one, and close the book. But he doesn't do that at all.
No, he doesn't.
He does something way more rigorous and honestly a little subversive to the traditional consensus.
He does. He puts the hadith to the side for a moment and he simply starts counting. First, he goes through the text of the Quran itself and he points out with alphabetical precision that a Quran actually contains at least 117 distinct names used to describe God.
More than 99.
He lists them all. And then he notes that there are still more names hidden implicitly inside whole sentences, like when God says, we are its preservers, or we are the doers. Those are names, too, just hiding in verbal forms.
So right out of the gate, the number 99 is mathematically too small to cover even just the Quran. And then he does something even more bold. He takes two historical lists of the famous 99 names, one from a prominent Shia chain of transmission and one from a prominent Sunni chain. He puts them side by side on the desk like an auditor checking the books.
And he shows, undeniably, that the two lists contradict each other.
They don't agree. Each list contains specific names that the other list completely lacks. Both of them totally skip over names that are blatantly obvious, major themes in the Quran. And both lists include a few names that aren't even found in the Quranic text at all.
For a strict literalist, a person who thinks religion is about collecting exact passwords, this would be a crisis of faith. But for A'Aleh-Meh, it is a massive relief. It leads to a profound reframing of what the religion is actually asking of you. He concludes that the number 99 was never, ever meant to be a hard cap. It is not a maximum limit. It is not a census of God's attributes.
So what on earth is the point of the hadith then? Why say 99? Why attach the promise of paradise to it?
The key is found in the specific verb the hadith uses. The Arabic word is ISAA. It roughly translates to comprehending, or taking them in, or enumerating with understanding.
ISAA.
Yes. The promise of paradise is absolutely not tied to rote memorization. It is not about being able to recite a specific, rigid list of 99 Arabic words as fast as you can, like a child in a spelling bee. ISAA is a lifelong devotional practice.
It's an internal thing.
It is about deeply, structurally internalizing the reality of those names into your own character. It is about the agonizingly slow work of learning to recognize the single divine reality through 99 different doors in your daily life.
It's the difference between memorizing the lines on a topographical map and actually walking the brutal, beautiful territory with your own two feet.
Exactly. But to walk that territory safely without getting lost, A'Aleh-Meh has to arm us with a strict rule. And he sets up a crucial distinction here that answers definitively the single most common objection modern skeptics have about religious language.
Right. Let me play the modern skeptic for a second. Because every time we say God knows or God loves or God hears, a modern linguistic philosopher or neuroscientist is going to raise their hand and say, hold on, stop. When I say my human friend Ali knows his way around the city, I mean something very specific.
They mean a biological process?
Yes. I mean, he has physical neurons firing, making chemical connections in a physical brain based on past physical sensory experiences. When you say God knows all things, are you really using the word know in the same sense? Or are you just speaking in loose poetry and metaphor, the exact same way I might say a river knows its way to the sea?
It is the ultimate inescapable question of theology. Is our language about God just empty flattery? Are we just making noises? Ah, L.A. May gives a definitive, rigorous answer. He says it is the exact same concept.
Wait, really?
It is not a metaphor. It is not poetry. When we say Ali knows, and when we say God knows, the concept of knowing is identical.
Wait, I have to stop you. Identical. How is that possibly true if God doesn't have a brain?
Because we have to separate the pure concept from the concrete instance. The technical Arabic term for the concrete instance is mizdak. The pure concept of knowing simply means that the reality of the known object is clear and present to the knower. That is all the concept means. That is the pure definition.
Okay, clarity of the object.
What differs and differs totally, infinitely, unbridgeably, is the how, the concrete instance, the mizdak.
Okay, let's break that down because this is the key to reading any scripture without sounding absurd.
When Ali knows something, how does it happen? He uses a physical brain. He relies on stored mental images, fragile memories, sensory data gathered through eyeballs and eardrums. His knowledge is dependent, it is reactive, it comes after ignorance, and it's entirely physical. Now, God has no brain. God has no mental space anywhere. God does not use images or sound waves or memory. But that is entirely a difference in the realization of the knowing. It is a difference in the how. It does not change the core meaning of the word. The known is perfectly, intimately clear to the knower.
So we can state the golden rule plainly for the listener, and this is a rule you must carry with you forever whenever you read any scripture or theology. Keep the concept, but ruthlessly strip away the creaturely packaging.
Precisely. Knowing. Yes, keep the concept, but entirely without the dependence on mental pictures or physical neurons. Powerful. Yes, keep the concept, but entirely without the necessity of physical effort, strain, sweat, or muscle.
Right.
Merciful. Yes, but without the hormonal wave of feeling, the psychological heartbreak, the emotional vulnerability that mercy requires in us. You keep the core word, but you ruthlessly, surgically remove every single trace of limitation, every lack, every physical dependency that clings to that word when we are the ones acting it out.
I'll be honest, this sounds incredibly difficult to do in practice. It feels like mental gymnastics. But Ah L.A. May shows that this is exactly, precisely how the Imams themselves talked.
They mastered this language.
This wasn't some later invention by medieval philosophers. He quotes a famous rhythmic, mesmerizing sermon from Ali, the first Imam. And I want us to read this deliberately. I want the listener to really hear the drumbeat of this logic, phrase by phrase.
Listen to the structure of these phrases from Imam Ali. He says, God is subtle in subtlety, but not described as subtle.
Stop there. He is subtle. Keep the concept of invisible presence, but not described as subtle. Meaning, don't imagine him as a thin gas or a microscopic particle. Strip the packaging.
Exactly. The Imam continues, before everything, yet none is said to be before him.
Keep the concept of priority, but strip away the idea of God standing in a temporal timeline waiting for the universe to start.
Manifest, but not by physical contact.
He is undeniably obvious and present, but you can't bump into him. He doesn't take up spatial volume.
Near, but not by being adjacent.
This one is huge. He is intimately close to you, closer than your jugular vein, but not because he is sitting in the chair next to you. It's ontological nearness, not geographic nearness.
Existing, but not after non-existence.
He is totally real, but he didn't turn on. He has no starting gun.
Hearing, but not by an instrument. Seeing, but not by a tool.
It's like a philosophical hammer hitting the same nail over and over. He's X, but absolutely not in the way creatures are X. Hearing, but no eardrums. Seeing, but no retinas. It's a constant rhythmic affirmation immediately followed by a ruthless stripping away.
Ah, L.A. May points out that this specific rhythm walks a razor-thin ridge between two massive, deadly theological cliffs. And the tradition gives specific names to both of these cliffs. On one side, if you slip and fall off, you commit the error of tadal.
Tadal, what does that mean in practice?
Tadal means emptying God out, divesting him. It is stripping him so bare of meaning that when you say God is wise, it essentially means nothing at all. You become so utterly terrified of comparing him to a human that you strip away the core concept along with the packaging and you make him a blank, silent void.
And the cliff on the other side, if I lean too far the other way?
The other cliff is Tashbi. This is likening God to creatures, assimilating him. This is the error of keeping the packaging. It's picturing God as just a very large, very impressive, very old man sitting on a physical throne in the sky, getting angry and throwing lightning bolts. It is bringing him down to the level of physics,
So Imam Ali's sermon hearing, but not by an instrument, is perfectly walking the knife's edge between Tattle and Tashbih. God really truly is all these things. He truly hears, so we avoid the void of Tattle. But he is none of them the way anything else in the universe is, because he uses no instruments, so we avoid the idolatry of Tashbih.
It is an absolute masterclass in theological language. And now, having built this tool, Elamea presses this point further than you might expect. He takes this golden rule and he swings it around and applies directly to us. He ties this entire abstract conversation about divine names straight back to the concept of borrowed being that we explored in our previous deep dives.
Let's make this intensely, uncomfortably personal for the listener right now. Because if we follow the logic, if every genuinely perfect thing, knowing, power, life, beauty, mercy, existence itself, if the pure, unmixed, original form of all those things belongs to God alone, how much of your intelligence is actually yours? How much of your power or your goodness or your creativity actually belongs to you by right?
Elamea provides a bracing, uncompromising answer. Every single real, defect-free perfection belongs to God exclusively.
Exclusively, meaning I own none of it.
Yes, whatever you have, whatever sharp intelligence you pride yourself on, whatever kindness you show to your family, whatever physical strength you have it entirely derivatively. You hold it by accidents. The Arabic term is bilarad. You hold it on a lease. You are riding on God's reality without ever, for a single millisecond, owning it outright.
That is an incredibly hard pill for the human ego to swallow. I want to say, no, I worked for this degree. I built this muscle. I practiced this patience. It feels like he is erasing our achievement. But Elamea insists this isn't just poetic humility, is it?
No, it is the strict, plain sense of the Quran's own grammar. He points to the specific, tiny words used in the text. When the Quran says, honor altogether belongs to God, or that all power belongs to God, those little qualifying words, altogether, they're not there for rhetorical emphasis.
They aren't poetry.
No, they're doing exact, rigorous metaphysical work. They are marking exclusive predication, or has. They're stating as a cold, hard fact of reality that the perfection is God's alone and everyone else's is merely a temporary lease.
But, and I want to emphasize this heavily so we don't fall into a kind of depressive nihilism where nothing matters, the lease is real. We aren't just passive puppets on strings or illusions projected on a screen. The creatures genuinely have power. You genuinely act. You genuinely show mercy to your children. The Quran is full of people doing intensely real things, making choices, taking actions.
Yes, the action is deeply real, but the ownership is entirely borrowed. Elamea's favorite case study for this tension is a stunning verse where God is speaking directly to Jesus, reminding him of the massive miracles he performed on earth. I want to read the verse from Quran chapter 5, verse 1 and 10, and I want you to listen closely for the repetitions. God says, when you fashioned out of clay the likeness of a bird with my leave and breathed into it, and it became a bird with my leave, and you healed the blind and the leper with my leave.
Three times, in one single flowing sentence, with my leave, Jesus really takes the physical mud in his hands. He really shapes the bird. He really uses his lungs to breathe into it. It is a genuine, creaturely physical act of creating life. But every single clause, every single beat of the miracle is stamped by God, with my leave. On loan, derivative. It is deeply, physically real, and entirely 100% borrowed at the exact same time.
And Elamea takes this profound understanding of borrowed power and uses it to interpret the ultimate future, the day of judgment. He reads the end of the world not just as the courtroom scene, but as a kind of cosmic unmasking.
A metaphysical reveal of what was always true.
Exactly. Think about our everyday lives right now. In this world, the chains of physical cause and effect are so reliable, so tightly woven, that we completely forget they're borrowing their power. We get sick, we take a pill, we get better, and we credit the medicine. We want to buy a house, we work hard, we swipe a card, and we credit the money. We lift a heavy weight, and we credit our muscle.
The middlemen get all the glory. We worship the medicine, the money, and the muscle.
But the Quran describes a day when all those secondary causes are suddenly violently cut off, the lease is revoked, every single middleman power is severed at once, the medicine stops working, the money means nothing, the muscle fails. And in that terrifying moment of absolute clarity, a question rings out across the entirety of reality and answers itself. It is from chapter 40, verse 16. Whose is the sovereignty today? God's, the one, the subduer.
Whose is the sovereignty today? It's not that God suddenly seized power back from us in a cosmic coup. It's that the curtain dropped. The borrowed powers, the middlemen, they just blink out of existence. And the truth that was there the entire time, humming beneath the surface of the world, becomes absolutely impossible to ignore. there was only ever one Omer.
It is the metaphor of the bowl and the sea from our second deep dive, but now it is playing out as the final dramatic scene of human history. And following that chain of borrowed power upward brings us, finally, to the absolute summit of the treatise. Because if names collapse into higher names, if mercy and provision fold up into power and knowledge, and those fold up into the living and the self-subsistent, that chain has to end somewhere. It cannot regress infinitely.
It has to have a peak, a final point.
It ends in a single name from which all the others flow outward. The broadest, highest, most terrifyingly powerful name of them all. The tradition calls it Allism Al-Azam, the greatest name.
Which brings us right back to Ammar al-Sabbati kneeling in the blinding heat of the courtyard, the cold open. Ammar wanted the greatest name. He wanted the magic word that raises the dead and teleports thrones across the world. So let's dismantle the myth right now. I'll ask the question directly on behalf of everyone who has ever watched a fantasy movie. Is the greatest name a password? If I find the right ancient manuscript in the right cave, can I pronounce the syllables out loud and bend the universe to my will?
Ah, L.A. May completely shatters that idea. And his logic is impenetrable. Think about what a spoken word actually is in the physical universe.
Yeah.
It is just a little puff of air pushed from your lungs, vibrating your fleshy vocal cords, creating a temporary sound wave that travels through the air for a few feet and then dies completely the instant it is made. A perishing, dying, temporary noise cannot possibly be the thing that raises a dead body from the grave. It's logically absurd.
Okay, fair enough. The sound wave is too weak, but what if it's not the sound? What if it's the idea of the word? The secret, mental knowledge held silently in the mind of the mystic.
Ah, L.A. May anticipates that exact retreat. He says, no, a thought is just a mental image. It is a dependent, reactive concept inside a human brain. It is equally a flimsy, passing thing. Whatever the greatest name actually is, the traditions say its effects are massive, real, and external, like moving a throne. Therefore, the name itself must be a massive, real, external reality. It cannot be a piece of human language at all. It cannot be ink on a page, and it cannot be a sound in the air.
So if it's not a word, and it's not a secret thought, what is it? What did Ammar ask for?
The greatest name is one of the ranks of the essence itself. It is the very highest, most foundational rank of God's own reality.
But wait, now we have a textual problem, because the traditions constantly talk about the greatest name having letters. There's a very famous hadith that explicitly says the greatest name is made up of 73 letters. How do we possibly square that text if we've just proved it's not language?
I will read the hadith, and you will see how beautifully Alaynay unlocks it. The tradition says, with Asaph, there was but a single letter of it. He uttered it, and the earth between him and the throne of Bilchis was rolled up, so that he took the throne in his hand. Then the earth returned to its former state in less than the twinkling of an eye. With us, the Imams are 72 letters of the greatest name, and one letter is with God most exalted, which he has reserved for himself.
Okay, let's unpack the story first. Asaph, serving as King Solomon's vizier, uses just one single letter to teleport the massive throne of the Queen of Sheba across the world. The Imams have 72 of these letters, and God keeps the 73rd entirely to himself. But A'elimeh points out the glaring logical flaw in reading this literally right. If these were ordinary letters of the alphabet, the whole story collapses immediately into nonsense.
Precisely. For one thing, there are only 28 letters in the Arabic alphabet. You mathematically cannot have 73 alphabet letters. And furthermore, everyone already knows the alphabet. You couldn't say God reserved one in secret if they were just standard consonants and vowels. So letter absolutely has to be a metaphor. It has to mean something else entirely.
This is the massive aha moment of the whole deep dive. If a letter isn't a symbol on a page, what is it?
A letter of the greatest name is a degree of fane.
Annihilation.
Yes. Annihilation. Total self-effacement. A letter is a depth, a specific degree to which a human self can be dissolved into a rank of God's reality. It is the degree to which you can stop being you until absolutely nothing of your private little ego is left, and only that divine rank remains, acting through the empty space where a person used to be.
I want to bring back an analogy we've touched on before, because it perfectly visually captures Fanenay. Imagine holding a lit candle in a dark room. You can see the flame. It has its own distinct borders, its own shape. It does its own little work of illuminating the dark. Now, take that lit candle, walk outside at high noon, and hold it up directly against the blazing face of the sun. What happens to the candle flame?
The candle flame absolutely does not add a second fire to the sun. It simply vanishes. It is overwhelmed, dissolved, completely annihilated into the infinitely greater blaze. It is still technically lit, but its independent identity, its borders, are completely consumed by the sun.
That is Fane. So when Asaph moved the throne of the Queen of Sheba, he didn't stand there and speak a magic syllable. For one single blinding instant, Asaph, as a separate, distinct self, was completely gone. He vanished into the greater fire. He was annihilated into the one rank of the divine reality at which that massive throne was already securely in hand. He became the transparent conduit for the name itself to act.
Exactly. The traditions even meticulously distribute these letters, these grades of dissolving across the prophets. They say a few letters were given to Adam, a few more to Abraham and Moses. Two letters were given to Jesus, and the report specifically says those were the two exact degrees of Fane by which he became the conduit to revive the dead and heal the blind. And the fullest human measure, all 72 letters, all 72 degrees of annihilation were given to Muhammad.
And it goes even further than that. In one of the boldest strokes in the entire treatise, A'Elema says that when the traditions claim that the imams themselves are the greatest name, it isn't just extravagant poetry or over-the-top praise. A perfectly annihilated human being, wholly, permanently dissolved into that highest rank of the divine, simply is that rank, now walking around the earth wearing a human face.
Yes, they are the name made flesh through total absolute surrender.
But there is still one letter left. The hadith explicitly said there are 73 letters, and the imams have 72. What is the final 73rd letter, the one God keeps strictly reserved for himself, entirely hidden even from the greatest prophets and mystics?
That final reserved letter is Ahadiyah itself, the pure, blinding, featureless indeterminacy we started Act 2 with, the pure white light before the prism.
Why is it reserved? Why can't anyone have it? Is God just keeping a secret for himself?
Because it mathematically, ontologically, can never be had. Think about it. The very thing that would be required to reach it, to claim it, a self, a knower, a subject, a someone, is exactly what absolutely cannot survive in that pure, featureless light. To arrive at Ahadiyah is to be gone completely. There is no you left to hold the letter. The Quran describes that ultimate level in chapter 22, verse 56, speaking of the final day. The kingdom on that day belongs to God.
No creature left in the frame. Only God remains.
And that, at long last, pays off the cold open. Now we finally understand why the house was spinning.
Amar al-Sabati. He comes to the imam, the man who embodies the name, and asks to be told the greatest name, the exact same way you would ask a friend for their wifey password. And the imam knew the terrifying truth. The name is not information you receive. It is a fire you are dissolved into.
The imam literally could not tell Amar the name. Words wouldn't carry it. He could only let Amar feel the raw physical edge of it. The house turning, the gravity failing, the self starting to vibrate and literally come apart at the seams. He let Amar experience the very first, barest hint of Fana.
And Amar felt his ego, his life, starting to unspool into the sun, and he pulled back in sheer terror. He said, "That is enough. I do not want it. I was about to perish." He wasn't refused the name by a stingy, secretive teacher. He met the name, and he learned the terrifying, liberating truth that it could not be had and survived. You either walk away or you burn.
It is a profound, earth-shattering reframing of the entire religious enterprise. We started this deep dive with a mathematical puzzle. How does the seamless, indivisible one from our first conversation come to wear 100 different names?
And the answer turned out to be that the names were never pieces of God. God is not a mosaic patched together. The names are doors into him. Whether there are 99 or 117 or 360 or finally just one, they are all simply angles on a single light. They are colors thrown by one beam, fractured through the prism of our human need to understand and relate to the infinite.
And so, comprehending the names, that practice of I-S-A-A that the traditions promise leads to paradise, was never a memory test. It is the slow, agonizing, lifelong work of learning to see the one reality through each of its many faces. It is learning to genuinely meet the merciful in every single act of mercy you encounter, to see the provider in every meal you eat, the light in absolutely everything that is lit, until eventually those faces all start to collapse and point back to the one single face behind them all.
And the concept of the greatest name, the absolute summit of this whole structure, completely reorients what it means to seek God. The deepest name of God is not a tool you can hold, hoard, and deploy to make your life easier or richer. It is a place you can only arrive at by disappearing. The saints and imams of this tradition are presented as the ones who actually did the disappearing.
For the rest of us, the names we can hold, the merciful, the forgiving, the near, are simply the accessible rungs of that ladder, They are the shattered, glowing pieces of the greatest names scattered throughout the pages of the Quran and the events of our lives, waiting for us to slowly gather them.
It's an overwhelming, beautiful picture, but it leaves us with a massive cliffhanger that we have to address next time. If everything good is exclusively God's, if every perfection is only borrowed by us, if even the number four owes him its evenness, and if the ultimate goal of existence is to dissolve entirely into his reality, then who is actually doing anything down here?
That is the inevitable, inescapable question that this entire framework demands.
Are we free? Or is it all just him moving the pieces on a board? If everything is from God, does that make God the author of our mistakes, the author of evil? That is the knot we are going to set out to untie in our next deep dive. We're going to dive into A'Elameh's third treatise, The Axe. It is entirely about the excruciating tension between destiny, free will, and the famous middle path between total fate and total freedom.
Until then, I want you to leave this deep dive with one final lingering thought. Just picture the sheer irony of it all. Imagine a man walking up to a master, asking to be handed the greatest name of God like a shiny brass key he can put in his pocket and take home. And the teacher looks back at him, knowing the impossible truth, that the absolute only way to ever hold that name is to stop for just a moment being anyone at all.